A few shows back, we asked our listeners to write in and tell us if they were introverts or extroverts. What impact has this had on their lives? Now, most of the people who wrote in were women, and most of them were introverts. People tend to think you're stuck up or stupid because you tend to keep a lot of things to yourself, writes this one introvert named Terry. Sue, another introvert, she says that she knew she was an introvert in college when she had to share a room for the first time in her life. I made an effort to find every quiet, isolated spot on campus, she says, from the obscure corners of the library to the dorm's laundry room at off hours where I could get my precious alone time. Another introvert who writes in regrets missing out on opportunities, but she says that she values the way she was, even if the outside world seemed quite puzzled by her. So, we have some interesting problems here. I mean, how do introverts fit into the daily grind? Well, I'm here to tell you, it's not easy for them. It is exhausting to get through a day, writes Jen, and I often think I will need to go home and take a nap. However, when I get in my car and begin driving home alone, I feel a renewed energy and strength that had literally been tapped from me in the crowded environment of cubicle hell. Roger, an introvert who started his own business, designed this unique product with more than 2,500 complicated parts. Really amazing. And despite his success, as demands increased, he threw himself into his work, and he still had to face what he refers to as this suspicious, sarcastic, and abusive rhetoric. But I was especially moved by an introverted listener who says that he has listened to nearly every episode of the Bat Segundo show several times to get through his day. Now, this is quite extraordinary because if you've been listening to this a long time, there are, you know, more than 400 shows. And he has this to say. The trouble with being an introvert is that selling is valued above all else. He also deals with this mercurial, narcissistic boss, but he's also facing a very hostile workplace environment. My immediate co-workers, he writes, are obsessed with sports and gambling, whereas I am passionate about literature. Theirs is a fixation that purports to entertain, fills out their days when they go home, or subsumes their weekends during football season. My obsession with reading and writing not only occupies the mass of my free time, it also seeps into the many tangential thoughts I have throughout the day when I should be concentrating on work. I've been told I come across as aloof at times. Possibly I'm perceived as different. And those who care are the ones who know I don't fit in with a corporate culture. But that's fine because I produce above par results and am one of the few people who can work for or tolerate my boss. It's not that I don't get along well or that I haven't tried to subterfuge who I am in order to hold my job for 5+ years. It's just that it's getting to be progressively disheartening and I need something to change. 5+ years. Progressively disheartening. Well, I'm here to tell anybody who is listening to this program that passion, your temperament, is nothing to be ashamed about, okay? Being driven by your temperament, especially when it is maligned or misunderstood by society at large, is something actually to be proud of. And if you're one of those people who feels the need to hide in order to survive, then I hope that this show, in some way, reminds you that you aren't alone and that you're with friends. And it seems a very ironic thing to say, and hopefully a hopeful thing to say, as we talk with a man named Arthur Goldwag, who wrote a book on extremism. I think being different while also simultaneously recognizing the fringe is really, I guess, what life is all about. Okay, so I am here with Arthur Goldwag, who is most recently the author of The New Hate. Arthur, you're a very huggable guy, but how are you doing?
I have no hate in my heart.
Hate in your heart. Well, let's get down to this business of hate. I mean, I couldn't help think of Mickey Rourke's line in Barfly when I was reading this thing. Hatred, the only thing that lasts. You started off, one of the starting points of this book is Richard Hofstadter's The Paranoid Style in American Politics. He pointed out that status politics was more likely to be expressed in this vindictive sense rather than through a proposal for positive action. So I'm wondering, to what degree is vindictiveness the natural mode of status politics? I mean, why don't we have a lot more hugging and kissing and love-ins like that? Why isn't that as much of a draw? Maybe we can start from there.
Well, I think it depends on which side of the status divide you are.
Yeah.
And I think on the relatively educated, prosperous side of the status divide, there's a positive sense of smugness that infuriates the people on the other side of the divide.
Can violence be smug?
Well, that's kind of the feedback loop of our politics, is we people get smugger and smugger,
and
they get more and more infuriated.
Yeah.
And it works to the advantage of people that aren't actually involved in status politics at all. They're involved in money politics.
Yeah.
But it works very much to their advantage.
I'm wondering, do movements and demagogues tend to time their vindictiveness in any way? Just looking at the various historical examples, have you noticed any specific vindictive trends?
Well, you know, we're living through such a bad moment. We're probably living, if America is going the way other big empires have gone, you know, we're beginning our decline.
Yeah.
We're well into our decline. And there were a lot of people that were doing very well in America who weren't doing so well anymore.
Yeah.
When you look at the history of the United States, when you look at it closely and not in terms of the stories that politicians tell on the stump, you realize there's been very few good times in this country. I grew up in an age of unprecedented prosperity, but, you know, it was an age of tremendous ideological conflict, and it was the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, but there was a lot of money, and thanks to unions and the New Deal, people that were relatively uneducated were doing pretty well. And that's not happening anymore.
But why don't they look at those achievements and say to themselves, well, hey, maybe I could be part of that? Why do they feel the need to be hateful? I mean, is there something inevitably wrong with the political mechanism that forces them to hate? Do people not really have a voice? And is this one of the reasons why they resort to vindictiveness?
These people actually... They couldn't answer that question because they never describe themselves as haters.
Yeah.
I went to a white nationalist convention in Washington a couple months ago.
Oh yeah.
And over again, they told themselves, because there weren't outsiders there except me and one or two other reporters.
Yeah.
They're telling themselves, look, we don't hate anybody. Our thing is we love white people. We love whiteness.
Yeah.
And I talk about that in the book, too. There's this, and Hofstadter, in a way, talks about it when he gets into the status politics. You know, if whiteness is the only thing you have, you're going to hold on to it very tightly. And then there's a whole complex of things that go with it. That, you know, they're not bad things.
Yeah.
They don't actually have anything to do with whiteness. I mean, one of the things I learned at this convention is, you know, that white people really love their families.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's not a white attribute. That's
no.
Just a, But the other side of that, of course, is if you love yourself to the exclusion of somebody else, is the somebody else. And there's this specter in America, you know, it's a darkening country. One of the speakers, he was a very moving speech in a way. He said, you know, imagine a country with no blonde women.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, you know, imagine it. There's countries in the world where there are no blonde women.
Yeah.
But if that, well, America's also, you know, we're an unusual country. We don't, blood and soil... It's a much more natural idea in Europe than it is over here.
Yeah.
Maybe as things are coming apart over here, it's starting to you know, it's starting to become a part of American identity now.
I noticed that you offer a smile every time you mention that things will fall apart over here. this leads me to wonder whether, I suppose, the erosion of the American government might, in fact, encourage people to love each other more. Do you think that hate will actually dissolve once we really don't have a political mechanism with which to contain it?
I don't, because I think that, you know, I'm not a religious person, but I believe in the fall of man. On the other hand, I'm not an optimistic person at all, but I believe we've made tremendous cultural and spiritual progress in this country.
Yeah.
You know, there's this incredible resentment of our African-American president, but he got elected by a landslide.
Yeah.
There's this just incredible homophobia, but in an astonishingly short amount of time, there has been, you know, such a raising of consciousness. I would have never imagined 10 years ago that gay marriage would be as accepted as it is today.
But so, we still have white nationalist conventions that you're attending.
Yeah, but they're small.
They're small.
What disturbs me and what made me write this book, you know, I had written this other book, Cults, Conspiracies, and Secret Societies, and it was encyclopedic, and it was like a browsing book, and it was like a gee whiz book. Like, these are the crazy things that people believed. And after the book came out, some of these people that I had blithely thought were crazy people kind of introduced themselves to me.
Yes.
And I discovered that, you know, that they're out there. And then almost simultaneously with the publication of my book and the inauguration of Barack Obama is the debut of Glenn Beck on Fox News.
Yeah.
And, you know, Glenn Beck, he's not on mainstream TV anymore.
Sure.
I don't want to give him more credit. He's an entertainer. But he was channeling all the stuff. I mean, if you had been as immersed in this stuff as I was, none of it was unfamiliar. You know, it's called the John Birch Society, basically. That's the template. And the John Birch Society template goes back to the origins of modern Western conspiracy theory, which is the fear of the Illuminatus.
Sure.
You know, people that are listen to rap music think the Illuminatus is something new.
Yeah. But on that subject, in the book, you cite tenuous connections to Michael Jackson and Jay-Z. I mean, how much does the Illuminatus or Masonic Society even matter in 2012 America? I got a lot of historical examples from you, but...
It matters in the imagination.
Yeah.
It matters in... it matters as an idea. I mean, real Masons are regular people. Some of them are very sophisticated people, but they're not the figures in the Dan Brown book or the figures on the cover of Jay-Z records. You know, they're it's something else. But ideas are important. You know, this is human beings live by ideas.
Sure. Well, speaking of living of ideas, I want to go back to this notion of the crazy people who were coming up to you after your other book. I mean, what do you say to reason with a crazy person? What is the gateway drug to get them on the road to sanity, so to speak? I mean, is it through things like family that you encountered at the White Nationalist Convention? I mean, what were your experiences and what are your tips?
I mean, I don't have any because I'm a really shy person.
Yeah.
And I take everything personally.
Oh yeah.
And
I hope you haven't taken anything personally with me.
No, but I mean it when somebody disgorges all this hatred in your face.
Yeah.
It's disturbing. I had one experience where I wrote about it in the book because it was funny, where 9/11 truthers came to a talk I was giving at a Masonic temple, and it turned out that the truthers, and this was new to me too because I didn't really understand the Ron Paul phenomena yet. But, you know, they were they were Masons, they were members of the John Birch Society, they were 9/11 truthers, they were anarchists, they were all these incompatible ideologies that make perfect sense if you look at the Ron Paul movement now. But they came to heckle me, and my strategy, I knew they were coming because I saw the thing on the internet.
Yeah.
And I addressed it in my talk.
Yeah.
I said, you know, here I am. I'm not actually paid by the Rockefellers. But, you know, we can talk. And that was very disarming.
Yeah.
Disarming
because you were willing to listen to them.
I was willing to listen to them. I was willing to talk to them. And so much of... you know, so much of what gives conspiracy theory its edge is, you know, I'm talking to a murderer.
Yeah.
I'm talking to, like, a paid flunky of the... And then, you know, but you don't really want to look in somebody's eye and call them a murderer.
Yeah.
It's like, you know...
Yeah, I killed two people last week, Arthur.
Well, look, at going back to this white nationalist thing, you know, they were... part of the deal was that you got a catered lunch if you went there. And I didn't partake of the food because I didn't want to break bread with these people.
Yeah.
But, you know, the waiters that were serving them were all Hispanic and African American people. I assume they were spitting in the food. I don't know. But they were bending over backwards to be polite to these people.
Yeah.
Because they have this idea of themselves as very good people.
Yeah.
People generally believe that they're good people.
Even the haters.
Especially the haters, which is, you know, that's part of the reason I wrote this book, is... when people see themselves, not that I expect to change a lot of minds, but if I can change some of the public discourse, if I can, you know, it makes it harder to talk about, it makes it harder to spew cant if somebody else is already, you know, if the people that you're opposed to know it too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this seems a good way to segue into Michelle Malkin, who you you bring up in the book. She posted an 8-part expose on the progressive climate of hate on her website. You write, "Clearly the right hasn't cornered the market on incivility or hatred, yet Malkin has also written some very hateful things about people. She's posted addresses and phone numbers of people who are trying to perform progressive action and the like. And as Glenn Greenwald and others have noted, her blog is a forum for anti-Muslim sentiments, bigotry, homophobia, all the things that are in droves within your book. So I guess the question is why do these people who promulgate hate insist that the opposition is doing it? Is this a way to, I suppose, shove the inherent identity problems on or fob it off on somebody else? I mean, someone like Michelle Malkin, she's been around for a long time now.
It's projection.
Yeah.
It's projection. And her, you know, when you break down her leftist, her what did she call it? Leftist hate.
Yeah.
You know, it's name calling. And God, there's a lot of name calling in the comment section of blogs.
Yeah.
What you don't have is, you know, the President of the United States or the Speaker of the House or the Governor of the state or high-level political candidates spewing this stuff.
Yeah. Although Bachman got pretty close.
Bachman got close, and Gingrich does it.
Yeah.
You know, that's his thing. I don't... And Gingrich is sort of a you know, it would be a very bad thing for America for Gingrich to get the nomination. It would be a very good thing for my book because he would be out there proving me right every day.
Yeah.
Gingrich doesn't have an ideology particularly.
Yeah.
He uses hatred as a demagogic tool.
But he has the moon, Arthur. The moon is a very peaceful place to counterbalance this.
And he says remarkably silly things with a straight face.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, but going back to the question of why these people are so driven to projection, I mean, it's, you know, do you have any ideas as to why people over the years have wanted to accuse the opposition of hate, why they couldn't find positive qualities?
When Herman Cain was melting down,
yeah,
I read again in the comments section on some right-wing blog, probably Michelle Malkin,
yeah,
or maybe it was Sarah, I think it was actually Sarah Palin's Facebook page, someone said, this is so unfair. When Democrats have sex scandals, nothing happens to them. Gary Hart got away with it. John Edwards got away with it. Bill Clinton got away with it. And I'm like, you know, Anthony Weiner got away. These are all people whose careers were destroyed.
Yeah.
Clinton was impeached. As it turned out, his career wasn't destroyed, but it was certainly, you know, he didn't get away with it.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. People want to believe, you know, aggrieved people want to believe that they're especially aggrieved.
Yeah, yeah.
Michelle Malkin wants to believe that she's a victim. I mean, you have, I don't know if you've read Pity the Billionaire yet, but
In fact, I talk with Thomas Frank. Yeah, yeah.
You know, he talks about how, you know, they turn themselves into the Yogis, basically.
Yeah.
The rich people are the victims of the Depression.
They mimic progressive politics
and they do it very deliberately.
Yeah.
And Michelle Malkin does it deliberately. And Rush Limbaugh does it deliberately. Glenn Beck does it deliberately. They're demagogues. You know, Father Coughlin did it back in the day, and he had a very confused ideology. I mean, it was he was very liberal in some ways. But he knew hate is how you push buttons.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I mean, the Tom Frankian idea that the right wing mimics the left wing. Do you think that this is also one of the reasons why they are trying to suggest they're maybe almost mimicking in reverse? You know, or rather, they're accusing the other side of mimicking their hate, and they're being in denial about it to some degree.
It's. You know, I talk about, in the beginning of my book somewhere, I talk about the trope of slavery. You know, the people that held slaves were the ones that were standing up and saying, you know, we shall not be slaves.
Yeah.
Some of it is just stunningly disingenuous. Some of it, I think people genuinely believe it.
Yeah.
And the only thing you can do is expose it.
Yeah. Well, this seems as good a time as any to point to the end of the book, where you point to the mission statement that William Buckley wrote for the National Review. You wrote that ideological purity cannot be found in our present world. You figured that Buckley was smart enough to understand that, as you say. But Revilo P. Oliver, the palindromic guy, one of the original contributors to the National Review, also in your book, he would later offer this very elaborate communist conspiracy answer to the Kennedy assassination. So what turns, I suppose, a more rational reactionary into someone who is this more hateful, conspiracy-seeking extremist? Why haven't people like Buckley been able to, I suppose, detect the early signs of kookiness?
Well, you know, Buckley had to kick Oliver out.
Yeah.
He fired him from, who did Buckley kick out? Buckley had to kick out Welch.
Yeah.
Welch had to kick out Oliver. That's, but Oliver was, he was a sick guy. You know, you read him and it's stunning how angry he was. And
but they needed anger in the beginning.
Well, I think I'm going to sound like Oliver myself now, but I'm going to say, you know, what drove him was a profound, profound hatred of the American project. And I'll borrow from one of the white nationalists that I heard, who said, you know, America was poisoned at its inception with the disease of the French Enlightenment. and specifically the idea that all men are created equal.
Yeah.
What a horrendous idea. Oliver is this classicist, which isn't to say that all classicists are snobs, they're not, but he hearkened back to this imagined hierarchical world. He looked at the onslaught of the barbarians. He hated the Jews.
Yeah.
You know, in with a kind of Nietzschean intensity, as he hated Christians. You know, he hated America.
Yeah.
The radicalism of some of these people on the right really is as extreme as any kind of radicalism you could find in the furthest verges of the left.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of them do sit very happily together at Ron Paul events. So it's true. Which isn't to say, I keep bringing up Ron Paul, he's like this utterly benign figure in the Republican debates. To me, he's the only guy that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Except I know where he comes from.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I can't parse it. I can't explain it. But I know that he's not what I'm seeing.
Yeah. Well, just to out of the interest of fairness, what of, you know, can you cite any specific anger that you might find on, say, the radical left? Do you think, I mean, there was that sort of line I quoted earlier that sort of mimics what Malkin was saying, but I'm curious, you know, for someone who is listening to this who's probably on the right wing, what would you say, you know, out of fairness, is why is it confined to the right wing for your book, or, you know, can you cite any examples on the left, out of curiosity?
I don't think it's as foundational on the left. And the other thing, you know, you get to, look, people said very nasty things about George W. Bush.
Yeah. Now,
I mean, a lot of that, I think, is at the level of people flaming on the internet.
Yeah.
It isn't like people running for office on that basis. But at the, you know, if you want to go to the furthest Maoist left, you know, I don't think they have a lot of relevance nowadays, but Glenn Beck does.
Yeah.
The Weatherman. Okay, I read the Weatherman Manifesto. It's a very violent tract.
Yeah.
Anyone that supports that is, you know, is calling for violence and destruction and did those people do harm to innocent people? Yes.
Yeah.
I'm struggling in a way because, you know, at the time that the CPUSA really was controlled by Moscow and was certainly a tool for the overthrow of America, 99% of the people that were involved thought of themselves as patriotic Americans. And they dreamed of a socialist America or a more equitable America.
Yeah.
I can't really, I don't really believe in, like, the moral equivalences.
Yeah.
I mean, the mainstream media does that for us. They'll say, well, Newt Gingrich just said something completely vile.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, someone on the left said something vile at one point. It's not really the same thing.
There is no equal time doctrine we could apply to hate. It tends to be more on the right than the left, basically.
I tend to think that the paradigms of right-wing hate, the paradigms of hatred are more amenable to some of the right-wing than the left-wing. I think, you know, a lot of temperamentally, I mean, somebody right-wing listening to me is going to say, you know, Abby Hoffman wasn't milk toasty at all, or something.
Yeah.
They're going to have to draw on some historical figure, because there haven't been that many prominent leftists in America over the last 30 years. I mean, this is the other Tom Frank thing. You know, he keeps pointing out, you know, they elected Reagan in 1980. They've completely taken apart the New Deal. But yet, Newt Gingrich is still insisting that he's an outsider and an insurrectionist. There's very little left for them to destroy at this point.
Yeah. He could continue to, I suppose, say that he's an outsider, and if enough people believe him, they will elect him, and this is sort of how...
Well, he's not only saying he's an outsider. I mean, I had this remarkable quote the other night when he said, you know, people power will defeat money power.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I want to see happen, too. So we're almost on the same side, except that I know he's just using it rhetorically.
This might relate to one point that you bring up in the book, that the New Hate is very much about this idea of a mythological golden age. Does it come from the goals of change from the protester being inherently unrealistic from the very get-go? I mean, how does American entitlement or our commitment to egalitarianism factor into, I suppose, the metamorphosis of someone into an extremist?
There's this very powerful idea that, you know, America is a place where anyone can get rich.
Yeah.
And anyone can get famous. And you look at who's on television, and it's clearly true. I mean, it tends not to be true when you you look at the people you know, because the people you know usually aren't rich or famous unless you're rich and famous. But it's a powerful, powerful idea. And people don't want to let go of it. And it wasn't true back in the day that the Horatio Alger books were being written. I mean, people rose. But nobody really pulled themselves up by their own bootstraps. I mean, we have, it's like, you know, the Wild West. What was the Wild West? It was this very brief period between the time that people came into the territory and then people came and built the infrastructure.
Sure.
Killed all the wild people, hung all the outlaws, set up the laws, opened up libraries, opened up schools, opened up factories, all the things that people do. But there's this dream. And, you know, we're a country that we do have revolutionary origins. They're bourgeois revolutionary origins. It was a completely middle-class revolution.
Yeah.
But people have this idea that you know, you don't have to be born into the nobility here.
Sure.
You can make it, and you want to hold on to that so badly.
And that translates into extremism. How exactly? When they are denied that American dream?
It doesn't translate into extremism for most people. It does for extremists.
Yes.
And I'm willing to say that, you know, extremism, natural extremism, is pretty rare. It's a very small number of people. And a lot of the extremists that you know about, they adopt it because it helps them politically. It helps sell their books. It help, you know, whatever. So there's not a lot of them, and not all of them even believe in what they're saying.
Well, this seems a good time to bring up William Dudley Pelley. He was this best-selling novelist, award-winning short story writer, and he went downhill fast in 1927. He starts work on this racial history of the world, and then he devises this elaborate corporate theocracy in response to what he viewed as a conflict of the ages. He has Jews confined to Beth Havens, white citizens owning shares of the state, blacks kept in service occupations, and of course, there's the foundation of the Silver Legion. So, he founded the Silver Legion largely because he was enamored of Hitler's anti-Semitism, but if he was, as you say, a first-class crackpot, what gave him such credibility at the beginning? Why were so many people willing to believe in the Silver Legion? What ideas and strategies did today's white power movements learn from this? I mean, you know, we were talking about innate extremism. I love this idea. Was he an innate extremist, or did he...
There's a direct line. The order and Christian identity and stuff, it comes right out of that. But these are small groups.
Yeah.
You know, and most of those guys are pretty articulate. Pelle was really unusual in that he was silver-tongued.
Yeah.
His books don't hold up. Nobody reads them anymore.
Yeah.
Nobody watches those Lon Chaney movies that he wrote. But he was very successful.
Yeah.
And what there's a little thing I just have to say this in case somebody doesn't read my book. I want them to. There's this parallel. Lyndon LaRouche and him both come out of shoe families in New England. You know,
look out for the cobblers.
and then you've got you've got L. Ron Hubbard, who was a professional writer, a hack writer, compared to Pelle, but you know, a very good writer. And Hubbard was much more disingenuous than, you know, Hubbard was in it for the money. I think Pelle believed a lot of this stuff. You know, I wrote a book about Kabbalah, and I'm not an expert in Kabbalah. I was learning about it as I wrote it. It was a popular introduction to it, and I introduced myself to it while writing the book in a lot of ways. But one of the terrible hazards of being a Kabbalist seem to be that almost all of them, including some really, really brilliant people, eventually broke down and decided that they were the Messiah. There's something about that level of intensity.
Yeah.
A lot of people, inferiority complex. And a lot of people just snap.
Yeah.
And Pelle was probably nuts. You know, he there's a quality of grandiosity about his writing that's amazing.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I will say the exact same thing about Hitler.
Yeah.
And under different circumstances, you know, Hitler was as improbable a figure as Pelle was.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you about the textual framework of the Protocols for the Elder of Zion, lifted in large part from a satirical text authored by Maurice Joly. This, along with Leo Taxel and Report from Iron Mountain, demonstrates how satire and pranksterism is often co-opted and becomes the basis for cults and conspiracies. Can such a level of misinterpreted satire transform, say, some sacred text into online hates? I mean, now we pretty much can Google it or Wikipedia it or ask someone on Twitter if it's legit or not. So, you know, is there anything along those same lines of woeful misinterpretation into the foundational sacred text for a potential movement that could happen today?
Well, this isn't sacred, but it just came out this week about these comedians in the early 90s that started the self-deportation thing as a joke.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
And then you have presidential candidates using this thing as if it's a legitimate idea. It's a horrible idea.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was what was the book that was I can't remember now. There was the best-selling ecological book that turned out to be written by a white supremacist, Little Tree or something. The Education. You know, the internet makes it possible to fix things right away, but it also makes it possible to completely perpetuate them.
Yeah.
It's a wash. The Taxol story blows me away because, and that's one that I wrote about in Cults, Conspiracies, and Secret Societies too. I just couldn't believe it was true. It's like something that somebody would make up.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that Revelo Oliver was a real person.
Yeah. He certainly doesn't sound like one. Yeah.
He sounds like a character in a Pynchon book.
Yeah. Well, in writing about the Catholic Church and anti-Semitism, you offer this off-the-cuff observation, something you could offer no research for. While almost everyone worries that their enemies are having better sex than they are, programmatic haters are downright certain of it. So, in the time since you have ferreted out this observation, have you encountered any research to further back up this claim of yours, or this idea?
it goes back to the question you were asking me about Michelle Malkin and so on. The desire to see betrayal. You know, these people, you know, they're gonna screw my wife.
Yeah.
They're gonna steal my children. It's so primal. And no, I can't back it up with research. But you read this stuff, and you know, you read the homophobic stuff, and the incredible potency of these people. You know, they can just take people out of heterosexuality with just a glance at them. If they're even mentioned in school, half the kids seem to... Where does this idea come from? It comes from, you know, a sense of profound insecurity.
Yeah, yeah.
People that, and then this goes all the way back to the status politics and Hofstadter again. People suspect that the ground is being pulled out from under them. And in many cases, it is. These people, they feel so screwed, and, you know, they're right to feel screwed. It doesn't have to be the way it is, either. But it can't be the way that they dream it should be.
Yes.
Because that's just a dream. It was never really that way. Hate politics distracts people from real politics.
Yeah.
Well,
on that note, I want to bring up the Ground Zero Mosque, which you feature in the book. You point to this blog post made by the Christian American Family Association's Brian Fisher, in which he wrote, "Permits should not be granted to build even one more mosque in the United States of America, let alone the monstrosity planned for Ground Zero." Now, you write that Democrats showed extraordinary cowardice in response to the outcry. You know, you got Harry Reid saying that it would be better if the Cordoba Initiative built its mosque elsewhere. So why has such cowardice allowed to flourish? I mean, why would the Senate Majority Leader give such hate power by sort of backpedaling in the face of a very tough election? I mean, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, you know, one of the things I'll say, again, I was really outraged. I was outraged at Harry Reid. I was really outraged at Abe Foxman and the ADL. I mean, really outraged. Because, you know, Pam Geller and Robert Spencer and Frank Gaffney are what Henry Ford was in the 1920s now.
Yeah.
They have demonized, except, you know, Henry Ford was attacking this pitiful minority. There weren't that many Jews in the country.
Yeah.
There's almost a million Muslims in New York. There's 2 billion Muslims practically in the world.
Yeah.
But something happened, you know, as scared as Harry Reid was, as it didn't take. You know, that minister, I'm forgetting his name, the Florida minister that was gonna burn the Koran.
Yeah.
When he came back to New York this year, nobody went to see him. When Pam Geller organized another rally this year, nobody went to it.
Yeah.
The Breivik in Norway killed all those people, and he wrote that terrible manifesto, and it really did poison the movement. It was a very similar phenomena to what happened with Tim McVeigh and the Patriot Movement. When somebody sees people putting their ideas into action, it really poisons things. I think a lot of this Islamophobia stuff is going to go away because I don't think that the country as a whole hates that much. You know, I think a lot of it is noise. And
so on one hand, the country's going to crumble, but you actually believe that they will get over their Islamophobia.
Well, that's what I said before. We're in... As far as bestriding the world like a colossus, America's not there anymore. You know, we've got terrible challenges. As far as dealing with like some terrible reactions and people that are trying to pull us backwards, it's a real challenge. But the country is culturally, spiritually, it's moving forward, I think. I'm really not that big a pessimist. I'm not an optimist, but I'm not apocalypticism is for the people that I talk about, not
sure.
me.
Sure. But the issue of democratic cowardice, which we only touched upon in this last answer, I mean, why would Harry Reid and other Democrats give such hatred power by refusing to basically say, no, you know, basically fuck off? You know, what are you talking about? This is absolute bile.
Because he was facing a very tough election, and Sharon Angle was going to use it. And, you know, but I think he blew it. I think, you know, I think Bloomberg looked great.
Yeah.
He was, and, you know, look, if the whole 9/11 thing is weird, because New Yorkers were much less frightened after 9/11 than people in other parts of the country. You know, when somebody mugs you, they do much better threatening to hurt you than actually hurting you.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody points a gun at you and says, "Do what I say."
Yeah.
They'll do it as long as there's the fear of something happening. Once it happens, you might start fighting back.
Sure.
9/11 was a catastrophe, but you know, New Yorkers also knew that it was something that happens, and you move on from it. I suppose there was a lot of irrational hatred here. I didn't hear that much of it until I left the city.
Yeah. Let's discuss Charles Coughlin. I mean, I was obviously paying attention to this because mm-hmm. this is radio, right? So he is the father of angry right-wing talk radio, as you point out. You point out that his concern for the poor and his belief in government distinguish him from many of the other talkers, to use a Tom Frank term that came later. So you've got Limbaugh, Mark Levin, Hannity. If they aren't offering this concern for the poor or anything like it, then, you know, what positive qualities do they bring that cause people to listen to them? I mean, how are they comparable to Coughlin in this way?
They're only comparable to Coughlin in that, well, actually, I mean, Coughlin had an arc.
Yeah.
And, I don't know if you've read David Graeber's Debt yet, which
no,
is
I have
an,
not
well,
yet.
It's an extraordinary book.
Yeah.
And Coughlin was a bazillion, and the bazillions hated usury, which is where his anti-Semitism comes from.
Yeah.
But there's also there's a lot to hate in usury, and there's a lot to hate in the debt system. There's a lot to hate in capitalism. You know, he started out, he was very pro-Roosevelt, but it was a mix of ideologies. He was a Silverite. There weren't Silverites anymore. They had gone out of fashion in the 1890s, but he was a Silverite. And he thought the way out of the Depression was going to be, cheapening money so that people could get out of debt faster.
Yeah.
And when Roosevelt paid no attention to him, he turned against him. There was a lot of class rage that was real class rage. He was as angry at the Eastern elites. Ultimately, he turned into a Nazi. And again, you know, let's give it to America, too. He lost a lot of his following as he went further and further to the right. And when he put up his candidate for president, he didn't deliver any votes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I observe this in other contexts. You can be a huge pop star in America and sell millions of records and have no political influence whatsoever.
Yeah.
A lot of these people on TV or radio, you know, they're entertainers in a way. They have a lot of influence, but ultimately maybe not that much influence.
Yeah.
A lot of the haters on the radio now have kind of different ideologies. I mean, You know, Rush Limbaugh is about money, I think.
Yeah.
Glenn Beck is about conspiracies. Michelle Malkin is about I'm not sure what. A lot of it is just, it's kind of crazy class rage. Ann Coulter, I mean, what is her ideology? She's trying to save Romney now. So she's suddenly turned her back on the Tea Party, whatever the Tea Party is. And, you know, really, what is the Tea Party? Some of it is a commercial enterprise. Some of it's Sarah Palin. And, you know, Sarah Palin exemplifies what I just said about pop stars. She's a huge celebrity and a huge pop star, but she doesn't have that much political power.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if these people are ultimately entertainers, how does entertainment translate into this hate? I mean, it's really fascinating. I mean, what you just said about varying haters or talkers quartering certain markets on hate, it seems to me that the, I suppose, all-purpose hate that Coughlin had has now fragmented over the years. This kind of actually worries me a bit. I mean, could you see more fragmentation of right-wing hate radio in the years to come? Or?
You know, people were talking about a right-wing crack-up now. Let's see. Let's see. Maybe the worst thing that could happen to them is if they win.
Yeah.
Because, you know, everyone's decided now that George W. Bush was too liberal.
Yeah.
But, you know, but there's all this cognitive dissonance, too. You know, people are so furious at Obama now because he's forcing Catholics to give out birth control, except that 99% of Catholics are customers for birth control.
Yeah.
And that you would have, you know, if the country were transformed in the way that the Vatican wants to transform the country, they would lose. maybe they wouldn't lose them. They would just have people doing one thing and saying one thing and doing another. I'm wandering off, but it's. Ask me a question, because I'm trailing off.
Well, you know, I think on that note of trailing off, I should commend you. This has been probably the most level-headed and calmest conversation I think I've ever had about hatred. So I think on that note, Arthur, it's a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Turning me